Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
I'm Dennis Foley. September is National Preparedness Month and time for you and your loved ones to make sure you know what to do in a time of disaster and making sure you have what you need during that said disaster. The American Red Cross's Stephanie Fox joins us on the show. Can you explain what National Preparedness Month entails?
National Preparedness Month is an opportunity for folks to kick off their preparedness practices or refresh them. It's just a month to really get an idea of what you and your family may need to do, what you may need supply-wise, how you'll get information in the event of an emergency, like a natural disaster, a home fire, things like that.
So with all these disasters, and of course we have listeners all across the country who may all experience a wide variety of different disasters in their lifetime, how do you approach each type of disaster differently? Or is there a way that you can just kind of consolidate everything to, hey, this is my disaster plan for anything that happens?
The best thing about a disaster plan is it really can apply to any type of disaster you could experience. The intricacies around what is included and what your family may need specifically, that's where it may differ person to person, family to family. But you should really start by taking assessment of your family makeup. Do you have pets? Do you have small children? Do you have folks that have medical conditions or may need electricity for medical devices? Do you have somebody who is elderly in your home? Take understanding and kind of gather what are those specific needs for each of those individuals in your family? And how would you meet those needs, whether you're going to be evacuating or staying at home and maybe your connectivity to resources is going to be a little limited. Maybe power's off for a little bit of time. Perhaps, the grocery stores aren't open. Maybe the gas stations aren't open. So you'll really want to take assessment of exactly what those needs are that would need to be met. And for each of those different scenarios, you're going to create a kit. And that kit should include specific supplies like non-perishable food items, water, extra medication. For your stay-at-home kit, you'll want to, again, look at things that could sustain you for a little bit longer of a period of time than you would for instance, if you needed to evacuate, to go stay at a shelter or an evacuation center or a hotel. So the difference between specific disasters really doesn't affect how you're building your kit. It's really what is going to be best for your family.
So for people and their own situations, how should people go about identifying their risks? Let's say you're in California versus Florida. Florida's probably going to probably see more hurricanes than California, but California may have wildfires or earthquakes. What should people do if they're not already aware of the risks that may exist around them? What should they consider? What is a risk? What's not a risk?
So there's a couple ways to go about it. First, I want folks to consider that because we are seeing an increase in extreme weather, we're seeing more frequent instances of extreme weather, and we're even seeing extreme weather happening in places that are not typically predisposed to that types of hazards. So I don't want folks to get too caught up on exactly what hazards are traditional and normal for their area, because you never know what type of hazard may pop up. But you should always stay in the loop with your local office emergency management. They can really give you an idea of what traditional hazards may affect your community in particular. The National Weather Service as well, paying attention to the watches and warnings and advisories and what they're talking about as threats and hazards to your community, specifically from a weather perspective, that can kind of give you an idea of what you're looking at and what hazards you may need to plan for. Also, with the Free Red Cross Emergency app, you can put in your zip code and it will actually show you some of the hazards that are traditional for your area and what you may need to plan for. So there's a few different ways to go about it to really get an understanding of what you may be at risk for. But again, I really want folks to not get too caught up on that hazard specific language and to really ensure they're preparing for any kind of disaster that could happen.
So some areas may also experience non-natural disaster hazards. You know, let's say you live near a refinery or, you know, some other. I think of a situation in Ohio with the train derailment that had hazardous items on there. You know, sometimes you never know when those moments may happen. In a way, it's kind of like you have to kind of play with the crystal ball and be like, oh, anything can happen. I need to have everything. But, you know, what do you do about risks that maybe aren't readily top of mind? Again, we think of weather, but other types of disasters happen too.
So that's where we definitely want to understand how our local county or parish is going to issue advisories or emergency alerts, right? If something happens to a refinery or with a train derailment or, you know, any of these no notice type events that may not be top of mind because they're not a traditional natural disaster. Your local community government will have a plan for that, and they will have mechanisms in place, whether it be text messaging or an emergency alert across your television, your radio. Perhaps they will have sirens. I actually live just south of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I am not too far from several chemical plants. So I know every week on Monday at noon, they test the alarms, and that would be our notification if something were to happen in the community. When we hear those alarms, that, you know, that triggers, oh, we need to turn on the TV. We need to pay attention to what's going on. We need to go on social media to check and see with our local office emergency management, what actions we may need to take or what we may need to be aware of. But definitely checking in with your local office emergency management where you live to understand what are those no notice type alternate hazards that could happen in your community.
So when these disasters happen, a lot of times people face the internal question of, do I stay or do I go? Generally, what's the rule of thumb? If someone's in that position, I mean, if it's a massive hurricane that's going to be blasting through your city, you probably should go. But there may be situations where it's actually better to stay rather than go, because of, you know, highway traffic or whatever the case may be. What are some factors that people should consider? Because some people might just plan on, hey, I'm just going to get in my car and go somewhere. Is that always the right move?
We really, really want to encourage folks that if their local emergency officials are telling them it's time to evacuate, it's time to evacuate. You really need to heed their direction because they're doing so for the safety of you and your family. If there is not an evacuation ordered for your area, but maybe you are reliant on electricity for medical needs, then you may want to consider where you would go. That could be a hotel or a friend's home in the next city over, or an emergency shelter with the local office emergency management or the American Red Cross or anybody in your community who sets up those shelters. But it really comes down to understanding what your personal needs may be, but absolutely following and heeding the direction from your local office emergency management and your emergency officials should they be ordered.
So the American Red Cross is usually involved in disaster responses when they do happen. Do you guys do any sort of preparation yourselves during National Preparedness Month? How does the Red Cross prepare to help those that are preparing?
We are preparing year round. We are in a state of nearly constant response these days, from wildfires to flooding to hurricanes. Even the most recent Hurricane Erin, while she didn't directly impact the U.S., she caused a lot of issues with rip currents and caused issues across the Outer Banks with some coastal flooding. So we are constantly responding and constantly ensuring that we have the mechanisms in place to respond whenever and wherever a disaster may strike, and whatever that magnitude of disaster it may be. So this month in particular, we are in the midst of hurricane season. We are almost at the peak of hurricane season. And while things have been pretty calm so far, we know that can change in an instant. We're also in the midst of wildfire season. So we are training up our volunteers across the country to ensure we have a steady, strong workforce to respond to the needs of a community, wherever that may be. We are taking stock of our supplies and our warehouses across the country to ensure that they are staged in the right places for the right time. We are doing a lot of outreach in the communities as well this month to really talk about what is National Preparedness Month. What are things people can do? How should they go about developing their plans, building their emergency preparedness kits? What conversations should they be having with their community, with their loved ones? So we are really doing the exact same thing that we are encouraging folks to do, and that is taking stock, that is being prepared, and that is putting the mechanisms in place for us to be able to respond to a community in need.
And a lot of what the Red Cross does is, you know, jumping into these disaster situations. I would imagine when people are more prepared for emergencies, it makes your guys' job a bit easier. Is that a fair assessment?
A prepared community is one that's going to be more resilient in the aftermath of a disaster. If you have things in place and you understand what you'll need to do to keep your family safe, what is going to work best for planning purposes, you're going to be a bit calmer in the situation. It's not going to be quite as much of a rush and a panic to do what needs to get done. And having those planning assumptions prepared and ready mean that recovering is also going to be a little bit easier. No disaster is going to be a cakewalk. It's always going to be scary and traumatic and difficult to navigate. But the more you can do on the front end, the better prepared you're going to be to start those slow steps of recovery and to understand where you may need additional assistance, where the Red Cross can step in, not just in the immediacy, but in the long term of your recovery processes, and what's going to be available in your community. A lot of communities have incredible organizations that are there all the time, not just that step up in the midst of disasters. So being aware allows folks to really react in the right way in the moment and then navigate their recovery in a way that's a little less hectic.
So, again, this is National Preparedness Month. What are some resources that the Red Cross has that can help people prepare this month and in general?
The Red Cross Emergency App is a great resource. It is free. It not only provides tips and tricks as far as how to be prepared, what different hazards you may have in your community, it also provides push notifications based off of your zip code. And those are fed in directly from the National Weather Service. So any watches and warnings that get issued, those will pop up directly on your phone. And you can get that critical information to you in a really, really quick manner. It also allows you to set up alerts for loved ones. So if you find your loved one's zip code of their area, you can get alerted to hazards that may be in their area at different times. So you can ensure that if your mother's in an area that, you know, maybe she doesn't always watch the weather, maybe she doesn't have a smartphone or she's not completely connected all the time, you can set up an alert so you can call and say, hey, did you see this weather that's moving into your county? Did you see that there's a risk for some rainfall coming in? And what can I do to help? Redcross.org is also a really, really good resource. We have pages and pages of information on different hazards, what to do before, during, and after those hazards, how to prepare. Again, those tips and tricks on how to build your emergency preparedness kit and what things you should think of. And of course, we want you to stay in touch with your local community, ensure you know how to receive warnings and where those will come from, and not just the Red Cross, but ensuring you know where additional warnings may be. You should be able to get alerts from at least two different places.
Awesome. Now, before I let you go, what would be your, I would say, number one thing to have in your emergency kit or plan?
We live in a day and age where not a lot of folks carry cash with them. We use our phones, we use our debit cards, but we don't carry cash. But if there is a disconnection from Wi-Fi or if the power's out, cash may be the only way for you to go out and purchase things if you need to go out and about to do that.
Stephanie Fox of the American Red Cross, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a trend that just seems to continue, young adults delaying or not hitting major life milestones. As Census Bureau data says, less than a quarter of American adults between the ages of 25 and 34 have achieved four common milestones considered to be the pathway to adulthood, moving out of a parent's home, getting married, working, and having kids. Nearly half of people in that age group did that 50 years ago. In fact, that was the most common situation for people in that age range in 1975. But today, the most common milestones 25 to 34-year-olds have achieved is moving out of their parents' home and having a job. So why do they have the situation? Well, my colleague Jennifer Hodges hit the streets to ask that very question.
I think for me, it's definitely financially. I don't think I have like the money for, you know, being an adult like how my family is and having a lot of children. I also don't really think that is like what I want. Personally, I just want to live, you know, with cats and, you know, get money. That's pretty much just planning to make a living for myself till I retire.
So you think financial when you think of kids,
yeah,
and marriage and that sort of thing, and that just seems kind of overwhelming.
But also, I just seen how like people have been acting these days, and people are just like not so motivated to, you know, make a family and be serious, and that energy is like something I try to stray away from. So I think it's better to work on being independent and mentally aware of the things that are surrounding you, especially like things that are happening in the news and around your neighborhood. I think that is just very important.
That's funny. I've heard that from a lot of people in terms of kind of motivation and things like that. What would you say? Kind of the same thing?
I basically agree. I think it's not just a financial part of that. I think it's also just like, I realize it's not something I want like kids, but something that I do want is like to like move out and like just seeing how unmotivated my siblings are, it makes me want to be even more motivated than they are.
Me too. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I'm just going to find a job, try to keep up with my schoolwork and just balance things out instead of just being unmotivated. And I know the option to just like stay home and do that, but I feel like in a way that unmotivate me because I have the option to just do nothing at home. But if I push myself to not do that, to actually, you know, like provide myself a home,
yeah.
Eventually I feel like I'll be able to do more by then.
You guys...
It's just because we... Like, what do you mean? Like, women are the new men, if that makes sense.
Well, no, like they're putting off decisions, like having kids or getting married.
Nobody wants to have a kid with nobody. Like, I wouldn't want to have a kid with someone that's going to sleep with 25 different people and never... You know what I'm saying? So it's like...
You feel like that's kind of how things are going
nowadays? It's 100% how it's going.
Like, really?
Well, 99.
Yeah.
Because I have kids in that age range, and they don't want to have kids. There's just a lot of uncertainty, and around here it's incredibly expensive. Yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, can't afford to feed yourself, let alone another person. Yeah. So
how old are they?
27 and 30.
Okay. All right. And I guess they're putting off other decisions too, like moving out of parents' house, you know, paying their own bills, that kind of thing. Have you seen that too?
Maybe with some of their friends, but not with mine. Mm-hmm. So they've been independent for quite some time. So, they are more than willing to, take care of themselves and not rely on us. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it is hard to live around here, so.
Yeah, yeah. Are you seeing it with their friends, too? Are people just putting off that, you know, those decisions?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I think a lot of them just don't even want to consider it at all at this point, you know? I mean, there's, I mean, it's just too expensive. And I don't know. It's not important to them.
Yeah.
Let's take a broader view of the situation with Bankrate financial analyst Stephen Cates. Can you just give me a broad assessment of what we're seeing in terms of this trend of young adults, 25, 34, delaying or not hitting, quote unquote, hitting major milestones to adulthood?
Yeah. So the major milestones that are sort of markers of adulthood or you know, still, I think, considerations of adulthood even today, although many are less likely, in being away from your parents. So living separately, working, having been married at some point, and having children. And, you know, a number of those are happening significantly later than they did many decades ago. Marriage rates are lower in, you know, in absolute terms. But when people marry, it's later. And when they have children, it's often much later, specifically in, you know, the coasts and in some of the bigger cities. You know, people are sort of crossing those thresholds at a much later date. And, you know, that's contributing to some of what we're seeing today, which is people are living away from their parents and they're working sometimes for many, many, many years before they're ever sort of entering into those other two, marriage and children, if they ever do at all.
So when did we start seeing this trend? Is this, you know, like a past 10-year type of thing? Is this a gradual thing? Was there some sort of spark that created this situation?
This has been a gradual thing. And you know, and I think, you know, you can look through a lot of the shifts in some of the economic data that points to sort of this gradual, sort of challenging environment for younger people. But, you know, also some of this comes down to the fact that more women are in the workforce, you know, more people are, you know, having trouble with home buying. You know, some of those are sort of the precursors in a lot of ways to what people expect is going to be that stable financial position where they can believe they're ready for marriage or ready for kids. And I think that's hard for a lot of people to, you know, sort of enter into when they don't feel like they're on stable financial footing. And that's something that we've seen, you know, as a gradual sort of deterioration over the last few decades. I'd say if there's any cause whatsoever to sort of spark things, I think the 2008 financial crisis is certainly a big one.
Are these trends a problem for the U.S. or is this just an evolution in how our society is operating that, you know, hey, this is the reality and things are going to change? Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think that there are aspects of this that you could look at and, you know, in a bad light. But, you know, the way we measure things is going to be the most important factor as to how we're judging, you know, younger people today. If we're saying that, you know, you aren't a competent adult until you're married with children, well, then we're going to have data that shows that people are not meeting that standard as highly as they did in the past. But, you know, if you're succeeding in a career and you're living independently, I would assume that, you know, I would view that as being an adult. You know, if you're paying your bills and you're saving and you're, you know, you're building a life in a community, whether you have children or not, or have a partner or not, I'm not sure if that's as key. And that might be a societal factor. I think people in the 70s might disagree with me in that manner. But I don't think you necessarily have to have marriage and a kid to sort of meet the standards of adulthood. I think that, you know, getting to a position where you are ready for marriage and ready for children, I think that that's a thing that we should aspire to. We're seeing very low levels of fertility. We're seeing very low levels of, you know, sort of populations of under five in some of the major cities like LA, New York, Boston, San Francisco. That is a problem for the country. When we have such low levels of, you know, population growth organically, that is going to come back to bite us. And we're seeing that certain cities are showing themselves to be further and further from a friendly childhood place, simply because there are fewer children and fewer places that are comfortable having children. You know, I don't think that's everywhere, because I live in the state of North Carolina that is is growing rapidly with an under five population. And I think that there's certain parts of the country that may be more friendly to that kind of lifestyle. And I think we're going to see more of a gap between different parts of the country in that regard.
Would you say this trend is about creating individual stability first?
I would agree that it is. I think that I'm not sure if, you know, everybody has necessarily a checklist that they follow, you know, in order to say that these are the things that I'm going to do, in this specific order. But, you know, there are higher expectations of getting a college education, higher expectations that, you know, you're going to have sort of this independent career. And that's certainly, you know, grown for women quite precipitously over the last few decades. You know, the amount of women in the workforce, you know, compared to the 1970s, it's much higher today. And I think that we'd all say that that's a good thing. But it certainly puts, you know, many people in a position where, you know, both men and women are chasing, you know, advancement in careers. And I think that that can put relationships and marriage and children to the back burner.
Is this a trend that will continue?
It's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen, but I think it's hard to look at a situation where, you know, without significant changes to our economic landscape, that we're not going to be able to change this. I think, you know, in my opinion, the low supply of housing, the extremely high costs, and added on to that, the high mortgage rates that we're having, puts many people in a position where they are frustrated with the economy, that they are, you know, basically throwing up their hands and saying, I'm not sure how I can achieve these kind of goals. And they're simply going in a different direction. You know, they're sort of adopting potentially the childless lifestyle, or they, you know, simply aspire to live in a different way, or they just give up altogether. And that is very sad. I think that's something that we're going to have to be very concerned about if it does grow. But I don't necessarily see, any way without major economic or societal change that will reverse that.
That's Bankrate's Stephen Cates. I'm Dennis Foley.
Listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit KCBSRadio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Barry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Barry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.